Okay, so we're putting on weight, and what's the risk? Well, as long as I'm over, if I'm less than 25 kilos, 25 BMI, I'm fine. Not at all. Here's the evidence, coherent from numerous studies, showing that by the time you get to a BMI of 25, you're in big trouble. And when WHO demanded Alan, you know, ever heard of a guy called Alan Lopez? Funny character. Somewhere, you know, lives a long way away from where I live. And he and Chris Murray and others got us all to change our way of thinking and asked me and the team, what's the ideal, somebody else did ideal blood pressure, what's the ideal cholesterol level? I had to do, what's the ideal BMI for the average of a population? And to my horror, when we looked at all the data globally, we came up with a number 21. And all the analyses that you'll see now are based on the ideal average population BMI of 21. It's not for mortality, it's for disease and disability. And notice diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, and since we're in the cancer foundation institution, colon cancer there, that's one of, was it eight, that we came up in the World Cancer Research Fund, reanalysis, the most comprehensive, mind-boggling exercise that I've ever seen undertaken. And it's really very clear. And if you say, well, that's just association, beautiful now studies show that if you use this ghastly bariatric surgery, you drop the cancer rates. Within 5 to 7 years, the cancer incidence rate by between 40 and 60% has all sorts of major biological implications and public health implications. So those are the galaxy of comorbidities. And this is Michael Marmot's mini review for the UK government. Do you have the same data to show that there's enormous socio-economic gradients relating to these comorbidities of obesity called the metabolic syndrome, abdominal obesity, abnormal lipids, high blood pressure, and diabetes. If you got that, that's metabolic syndrome. And if you all look as though you're in grade one. You're highly expensive, top-notch civil servants. And I'm a clerical support officer. And actually, you know, it's not that I'm more stupid. I just live in a different world. And there's this amazing gradient of illness and sickness related to socioeconomic gradient. And it gets worse. Here is what came out a couple of weeks ago, which if you look at life expectancy, this is for UK data, but it's actually been shown, roughly speaking, across the world. And you take life expectancy at the top, and you have the most deprived on the bottom left, and the least deprived, the super elite like you, up there. Then you have a difference in terms of life expectancy, and I think it's roughly 10 years. But now look at the life expectancy of disease-free existence. And this is the astonishing, brilliant analysis, which shows that that difference between the rich and the poor amounts to 20 years. Furthermore, I know that you retire at the age of 45 or something, but in poorer countries, we retire at the age of 65 to 68. And please note that the lower half of the population is seriously sick before they retire. So it's an economically extraordinary problem, and I think we ought to be getting this in all the countries. The UK government paid Michael Marmot. And the more you look at that report, which is now on the web, astonishing opportunity to transform political thinking in the way in which one should work. Then about 4 weeks ago, the Heart Forum had a look at the problem of diabetes, because they knew that diabetes was a major factor in cardiovascular disease. And they knew that we're getting older, as in Tasmania, we came from Tasmania this morning, worried about the aging population. If nobody got any more obese, you can get a further increase in diabetes simply because people are getting older, and that's the aging effect. But if you, can you just see it in green? If you take into account the predicted further increase in obesity, and I think, on the basis of the evidence, you're guaranteed almost this unless you do something major about it in Queensland. Your diabetes rate's going to escalate. You need new eye clinics. You've got to have new... You better start training all the blind dogs, and you better get kidney dialysis systems going, as we told the Deputy Prime Minister, Premier, this afternoon. It is completely unsustainable. No country in the world can cope with the economic costs of this pandemic. Then in December, WHO started reanalyzing things, and they looked at the cost of illness of whatever type that they could measure. And if you are from the high-income countries, this is the stacking of the risk factors that are inducing disease. Tobacco is still at the top, alcohol, and then overweight and obesity. And as you know, last week in your journal, Michael, the Western Australian analysis suggests that obesity has gone up to the top because the smoking rates are dropping. But this gives you... Now, the other thing is high blood pressure I'll come to. That's dietary and physical activity. Glucose, diet, physical activity, physical inactivity, high cholesterol. Out of that, and low fruit and vegetable intake, number 10. Out of those top, you've got 7 that are in food or physical activity. So actually, we've got ourselves completely wrong in medicine and public health, because this food system has been left to the idea that all you need is a sophisticated dietitian telling and educating people what to do. Complete garbage. So we've got fat because there's been a transformation of society. How many of you cycled here tonight? Congratulations. You look so elegant and intelligent and so on. How many people walked here tonight? Oh, well, I'm very impressed. You obviously live in these sort of penthouses that I've just been passing. This is another example of how you get old. But it's actually a secular change in physical activity demands. And we calculated for the UK government in 30 years ago that the intake of everybody should have dropped on average by 700 calories. And in the United States, it's gone sky high in terms of intake going up, not down. And why is this going on when biologically we've got a brain that actually is pretty good at keeping us in reasonably steady weight? The brain is brilliant at stopping you starving to death. It's not as clever if we really stuff ourselves slowly. Now, I'm not going to talk about physical activity much because I think that's an enormous challenge and it's fantastically important. And I would just highlight that as I whizzed through Brisbane, it seems to me that you're trying to outdo the United States and the other terrible countries, Britain. And we got it all wrong, fundamentally wrong, because we were locked in to motor cars and completely inappropriate use of petrol. And it was industry that forced the governments to think that this was sexy, and we all were manipulated. It's Frankfurt, Groningen, and in the Netherlands and in Denmark. They've transformed society so that you can actually live and breathe. I couldn't tonight quickly find where Brisbane and Sydney were on the map, which shows urban density and misuse of energy is all locked up with an environment where people don't ever walk. It's been beautifully shown in lovely scientific analyses by the British government, the chief scientist, that the environment is critical for spontaneous physical walking. That's one reason why Londoners who actually work are substantially thinner, because people are walking, and we've done everything in our power to stop cars being used to bring people to work. And here's wonderful data that I was stimulated to put in by my good friend Adrian Bauman, because we had a discussion about, is the recipe to get everybody going to the gym? I've been against it. Not only do I hate gyms, but are you going to have everybody from the age of 5 to 85? The whole population as a public health policy go to the gym? And then he showed me that if you take somebody who, like me, is busy, so I never watch television, it's 1 hour a day. It doesn't matter really for the group whether I'm on a high physical activity in my leisure time, in other words, I go to the gym, or if I just go for a trot, I'm moderate, or I don't bother, but I just wander occasionally, or I'm completely inactive. The average BMI is not affected by the intense physical activity, contrary to popular belief. And actually, the athletes who come home and collapse in front of the television, they're the characters who put on a lot of weight. In other words, it's the integrated 24-hour time that we have to think about, not simply the advantages which are there of intense physical activity. What about the food system? I suddenly realized that Australia was on this map. And this is a map that was generated originally by George Bray and Barry Popkin, where the proportion of the population that are overweight or obese is on the ordinate. And here's dietary fat coming out here horizontally. And there's Australia. Okay? You congratulate yourself. You're so sporty that you're just below the line. Isn't it fantastic? Apparently you're the best armchair watchers of sport, according to Adrian Bauman, in the world. And I had to talk to the Prime Minister of the Caribbean, and on the plane, I was frantically trying to find data on the latest overweight and diet pattern of the Caribbean, and I put them in red, I inserted them, and I thought, oh my God, what's going on? Because they're all above the line. Any critic will say, yeah, well, it's not right. I slowly realized that actually, quite interesting, because they have a huge sugar intake. And if you look at what's been happening, I tried to persuade China in the 1980s to actually take a grip in public health terms, and they thought I was a lunatic, which was fair, and they now have the fastest moving epidemic in the world of diabetes and hypertension. Jamaica, which is a wonderful country in agony, they actually didn't have a problem with obesity at all when I originally worked there in the 60s. So is this general association? No. It's backed up by beautiful double-blind controlled studies. Top left, where we take people and we feed them the same meals and so on, but we secretly manipulate the fat content, so it's either 60, 40 or 20% fat. And these three groups, on average, eat the same amount, just carry on eating their usual amount, and their brain somehow doesn't recognize that if you're on 60% fat, you progressively gain energy, and you store 2 days of food energy within the first week. And your brain somehow doesn't monitor that, despite what I've said. And also, gorgeous studies over 10 weeks, bottom right, which if you dupe people in Copenhagen and they think they're on a psychological experiment and actually they're on a weight balance experiment. And one group has sugary drinks available all the time. And the other group has drinks available all the time, zero calories. None of them understood that their weights were progressively increasing over that 10-week period if they're on soft drinks. And the evidence in CDC's latest analyses confirmed that it really does look as though soft drinks evade the appetite. And I failed to realize originally in our analyses there are about 60 papers that actually show this. And how fat evades the brain system is not entirely clear. But if you conduct these experiments under two circumstances where you keep people inactive, then on the left, if you're sedentary and very inactive, you have to be on a 20% fat diet not to put on weight in your spontaneous eating. And if you're sedentary and you're exposed to a Queensland diet, the Australian diet that I've seen everywhere I've gone this week, you're guaranteed to put on weight. In fact, you have to be very active indeed to make sure you maintain energy balance at a 40% fat. After a week or two, your brain will get on the alert if you're losing weight. Won't be quite so worried about you gaining weight. But there's no way on these rotten diets that you can cope, even if you're pretty physically active, if you're on a high-fat, energy-dense diet. So what we're now seeing is a concept where high energy density, sugars and fat precipitate obesity, and that's locked into cancers, diabetes, hypertension, coronary artery disease, and it interacts with physical inactivity. So the guys who say physical activity is the only important thing, they're mad. The nutritionists who say physical activity is valuable, but it's not terribly important, they don't understand the science. And the problem is, how do we cope with that complexity? Actually, there are independent evidence, and I've shown it in arrows, where actually even if you are obese, extra physical activity helps prevent diabetes, similarly for hypertension, similarly for heart disease. But that interaction goes on. And there's pretty good evidence now that the fruit and vegetables and so on, all this nonsense we've talked about, really can be shown to be protective. Our World Cancer Report showed it doesn't seem to come through as powerfully as obesity in our latest analyses, but nevertheless, it's protective. Oh. Now, everybody says, well, heart disease is coming down in Australia, but obesity is going up and diabetes is going up. That doesn't make sense of that. And what they neglect is the fact there are other factors. So, in fact, if you reduce your trans fat, do you see that? And I haven't yet had anybody telling me what the trans fat intake is in Australia. My guess, what?
It's low.
Do you know why that is? Because what was discovered about 8 to 10 years ago was the food industry realized that they wouldn't have a problem eliminating trans fats. And in many societies, but not in most of the developing world, the industry recognizes that they have to anticipate this problem. And industry is responsible for that. In Denmark, they banned it. And you go to prison for over 6 months if you're the chief executive of a company producing trans fat-containing food. Fantastic effects. Saturated fat at the bottom. In other words, if you change these other factors, you can still get a drop for the time being in heart attacks, even though the other promoting factors of obesity and diabetes are going up.